Welcome, great patriotic friends, to November 25th on Joe's Daily U.S. History Lesson. It is I, your host, Joseph DeCristoforo, and on this show, I cover a lot of ground very quickly, and I talk fast, so please have your pencils ready. Or, better yet, if you miss something, you can just listen to it again. I assembled this podcast in a tool shed in my backyard in La Mesa, California, right next to America's finest city, San Diego. If you're looking to move to the area, or if you have any questions about real estate, check out TeresaLovesRealEstate.com. Because as a full-service Encinitas and San Diego real estate professional, Teresa works with buyers, sellers, and investors in real estate transactions. So check it out, TeresaLovesRealEstate.com. And now let's begin the show as we customarily do with the Pledge of Allegiance. Let's everybody stand up, face the flags if we have one, put our right hands over our hearts, and begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. All right. And now on to today's headlines. We'll wish a happy birthday to American Revolutionary Spy Robert Townsend, plus another happy birthday to Andrew Carnegie, the Great Appalachian Storm, and the Greenback Party convenes in Indiana. All right, so now here I go. 1753. Happy birthday, American Revolution spy Robert Townsend. Out of all of the members of the Culper spy ring, Major Benjamin Tallmadge, codename John Bolton, Caleb Brewster, Abraham Woodhull, codename Samuel Culper Jr., Austin Rowe, and Ann Smith, Townsend was the least known. That's because he made Woodhull swear that his identity would never be revealed, not even to General George Washington himself. In fact, it would take the forensic findings, Morton Penn, and the penmanship comparison that show that Robert Townsend was, in fact, the same man as Culper Jr., actually, the most active member of the ring. From Oyster Bay in New York, Robert was one of eight children of Samuel and Sarah Townsend. Samuel was a Whig and liberal Quaker, and Sarah was an Episcopalian. They owned a storefront, and Robert worked there during the Revolution. In a British-occupied New York, he was able to see all sorts of activities and movements with the Redcoats, information that would prove critical to Washington. Robert Townsend wasn't the type you would think of as one of the American Revolution's biggest heroes. He was very quiet, rather shy, and didn't like to get involved in other people's business. But his dad was a different story. Samuel, whose store was perhaps the busiest of all stores in Oyster Bay, was a bit of a loudmouth. During the French and Indian Wars, he apparently sent a very strongly written note complaining about the British treatment of POWs. And for his insolence, Samuel was arrested and jailed for a while until he, you know, changed his mind. Old Samuel may have been concerned about the well-being of his son, so small and timid compared to his brothers, especially when Robert got an internship at a merchant house in a very dangerous Manhattan ghetto. But he may have been even more worried when Robert fought briefly in the futile battle for Brooklyn Heights. When the British fully occupied the city of New York, they basically had the whole town under house arrest. The Redcoats would take to moving in whichever house they wanted, and since Samuel was such a loudmouth in the past, Lieutenant Colonel John Sincoe was delighted to take over the Townsend home. On a side note, this is another reason why the British lost the American Revolution. If you have to declare martial law to citizens, those citizens will probably not like you for the most part and will lash out if they get a chance. The details of how Robert Townsend, the meek and mild unlike his strong and brave brothers, would not surprisingly align himself with the patriot cause, but the details of how he became a member of the spy ring goes beyond the scope of his birthday today. But you can see why he was absolutely the perfect spy. Long after the Revolution ended, Robert and his brother Solomon tried going into business together, but it failed. Though Solomon would have no fortunes to show for when he died, his son Solomon Jr. wound up becoming the wealthiest merchant in Oyster Bay. Robert himself would continue to live on in obscurity until his death on March 7, 1838, age 84. He's played by Nick Westrate in the AMC drama series Washington Spies. Happy birthday, Robert. 1835. Happy birthday, Scottish-American industrialist, business magnate, and philanthropist, Andrew Carnegie. From a town called Dunfermline in Scotland, Andrew's father was a hand loom weaver facing a bad economy. The Carnegies immigrated to America in 1848, settling in Allegheny, Pennsylvania. A young 13-year-old, Andrew went to work right away in the American cotton fields and learned his reading and writing skills by attending school at night. He began working directly for the big boss man, Thomas Scott, at the Pennsylvania Railroad Company while still a teenager. Andrew's thirst for railroad and business knowledge never seemed to end, and Scott was his perfect mentor. By 1859, it would be Andrew who would become the big boss man of Penn Rail. He began investing in the sleeping car company, which is just that. It's a train that features beds you can sleep comfortably in for overnight travel. He also began investing in all the top railroad markets and started traveling to Europe on a regular basis to sell railroad securities. By the time he was 30, Andrew Carnegie was earning over 50 G's a year. Back in the 1860s. I don't even think I was making that kind of money when I was 30 in the year 2000, let alone what its proportionate value would be today. But that's why I'm not Carnegie. Carnegie was just getting warmed up, actually. He invested into oil and bridges, earning a fortune in the Keystone Bridge Company. Sometime around 1872, he got into the steel business, coming up with the Carnegie Steel Company, and that set Andrew Carnegie over the top for good. His innovation led to changes in production that made the steelmaking process more resourceful, using a newer German technology known commonly as open hearth furnace to melt steel more efficiently. Carnegie not only had the process, but also owned the fields that produced the raw materials, as well as the ships and other transportation methods used to carry it to his mills. He owned it all. It is how he got on the very elite list of American builders, and by 1889, Pittsburgh Carnegie Steel was the largest steel company on planet Earth. In 1892, salaries were cut for the workers one day when he was out of the office, and a strike ensued, which became known as the Homestead Strike of 1892. In 1889, he wrote a book called Wealth, which in 1900 would be published with the name The Gospel of Wealth, in which he writes, "Any man who is wealthy has a duty to use any extra leftovers for, quote, the improvement of mankind. Any man who dies rich dies disgraced," unquote. Tough talk, right? Especially for a guy who's by now richer than John D. Rockefeller himself. Well, my friends, Andrew was a true philanthropist after all. He consolidated all of his companies into the United States Steel Corporation, and in 1901, 65-year-old, ready-for-retirement Andrew sold it to J.P. Morgan for around $250 million, a transaction that some economists believe violated antitrust laws. Carnegie lived up to his word and spent his retirement giving 90% of his extra cash away to world peace, education, scientific research, and, because he loved to read, libraries. Almost 3,000 libraries, in fact, were built from his donations. Well over 100 years later, he still has universities in Pennsylvania and Scotland named after him. Andrew Carnegie, many consider the beacon of capitalism. Understand the market, hustle your tail off, learn from your mistakes, become the absolute best, and then give back what you can to the community. Like a capitalist boss! Happy birthday, Andrew! Great Appalachian Storm of November 1950, as some would call it the storm of the century, slammed into New England and affected a total of 22 U.S. states. Throughout New England, as well as part of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia, 1 million people lost power and travel was impossible for several weeks. New York City recorded 94-mile-an-hour winds. In some parts of New Hampshire, winds blew up to 160 miles an hour. In all, 353 people were killed and caused over $60 million in 1950 dollars. 1874, the first Greenback Party convenes in Indiana. During the Civil War, $450 million worth of paper money called greenbacks were printed as legal tender, not backed by specie or gold and silver reserves. In 1873, President Ulysses Grant took America off the silver standard, leaving gold as the lone financial backing. This did not help the farmers and debtors in the West and the South, who didn't have access to gold and wanted more greenbacks pumped into the economy to create an inflation that would pay off debts made in times of high prices. Conservative Democrats supported the idea of greenbacks, but wealthy creditors within the Republican Party wanted the greenback eliminated from currency altogether. It was on this day in 1874 that an independent party of greenbacks met in Indiana to call for a national convention. The Greenback Party chose Peter Cooper from New York to represent the party. The Resumption Act of 1875 allowed the Treasury to buy back 1/4 of the greenbacks in circulation from the general public and pay for them in gold at its current value at that time, which is a whole nother story. In the election of 1876, Cooper would gain a total of 0.9% of the popular vote. Rutherford Hayes of the Republican Party would win the election. 2 years later, the party realigned its interests with unions, who were having their share of unrelated problems, as well as women's suffrage movements and increasing income taxes, and became the Greenback Labor Party. They were able to get 14 members of the Greenback Party elected into Congress. Now the Greenbacks were on a roll. By 1880, James Weaver of Iowa, who was determined to increase the nation's money supply and control big business, ran twice but lost. Though his 3.3% for a third party in any presidential election was impressive. By 1880, the economy had begun to stabilize somewhat. The Resumption Act had been a success. The Bland-Allison Act, which brought silver back into legal coinage, a loss in the 1880 presidential election from candidate Benjamin Butler with an embarrassing 1.7%, the Greenback Party had become obsolete.
And so that, my friends, is going to wrap it up for November 25th on Joe's Daily U.S. History Lesson. Once again, I'm your host, Joseph DeCristoforo. Check out the website, joesdailyushistorylesson.com, as well as the Facebook page. Let me know what you thought about today's ep. Or what about the stuff that's on the website that I didn't talk about? What's your take on the retaliation of the Little Bighorn Massacre? Like I said, on this show, I talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. Or what about the Greenback Party? Does it have any place in today's society? Yeah, let me know. Be sure to check out tomorrow's episode. FDR switches up the Thanksgiving holiday. Plus, The Bird plays the greatest jazz session ever. And Larry Holmes squares off against Randall Tex Cobb. So don't miss that. So until then, thanks for listening, everyone. And thanks for being great patriotic Americans. We'll see you then.